Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Optusport Football Podcast. Joining me today, as always, is a man who has spent most of the Christmas break posting photos on social media of different beaches in the Dominican Republic. Hard life, huh, Phil?
It was actually quite a challenging week, Mark. Really quite demanding, having to choose which restaurant we were going to eat at, which beach we were going to go. Should we go to the beach or should we go to the pool? What water activities we should do? So, yeah, no, it's been actually really quite draining. So I'm back and happy to get back to the regular life of doing the podcast with you, which is a lot less challenging.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd hope so. And I feel for you, mate. I really do. It looks very challenging for you. Yeah. And also joining us is Jacob Tanswell, who writes about Aston Villa for The Athletic. And I'm sure you've been working a bit harder than Phil over this festive period.
Just a little bit. I don't want to take anything away from Phil, but yeah, I've just mainly spent in Birmingham travelling up to Manchester too. So not quite the same.
No. I mean, don't think you'll find any beaches on the way up there, do you?
No, only motorway, sadly.
Yeah. And they're not the prettiest either, let's be honest. lots of Premier League football over the festive period to catch up on. Let's start with Liverpool, top of the table. Let's just think about that for a little bit, because nobody really gave Liverpool much hope to firstly challenge Manchester City. And I think we're kind of getting back to the Liverpool that we expected to see last season, and they've struggled a bit. That outstanding performance against Newcastle, but there still is a big but there, isn't it, Jacob? The fact that they weren't prolific in front of goal, wasted a lot of chances, and actually could have dropped points or even lost that game at some stage at that game.
Yeah, for sure. You look at the XG, I think they recorded the highest XG in Premier League history. I think it was 7 or something, which was pretty remarkable. And, you know, they are having issues in box. I don't think they're quite as clinical in both boxes as they were a couple of years back, although they've still got that same energy now. They've rediscovered it through reconfiguring the team. But it's going to be very interesting. I'm sure we might come on to it, Mark, that, you know, Mohamed Salah's going to be missing, and he's probably the most clinical and, you know, the most ruthless of them all. So it'd be very interesting to see if, you know, these problems, although they've been doing so well, eventually do rear their head and come back to bite them.
I mean, look, Phil, I had him in my fantasy football team, right? So he scored massive over the weekend, Mohamed Salah. So he was brilliant. So I'm going to miss him through the AFCON. Yeah. I mean, how big a miss will he be? I mean, he's in 6.5 years, he's only missed 10 league games. It's going to be huge for Liverpool, isn't it?
Do you know who I had in my fantasy team? Darwin Nunez. Darwin Nunez. I mean, he should have had at least a couple of goals in this game. And, you know, big question marks about his finishing. And it feels like we've been waiting a while now for Darwin Nunez to get going in front of goal, because in terms of his all-round game as a centre forward and a striker, he seems to have everything apart from the ability to consistently clinically take chances, which is a pretty big thing that you need for your striker. But it feels like once that clicks, if that comes, then he'll be a really extraordinarily good player. But this game was just another example of him not being able to clinically take chances. And the one player who is really, really clinical for Liverpool is Mo Salah. And obviously, they are going to miss him. I was looking there. It feels like Liverpool have got they've got a pretty good squad. They've got strength in depth, and they've got players that can make the difference from the bench this season. I went through and I had a look at the goals scored from substitutes from Liverpool this season, and actually there's been loads. So Gakpo scored against Newcastle, Jota scored against Burnley, Harvey Elliott scored an injury time winner against Palace, Endo scored against Fulham off the bench, Luis Diaz scored an injury time equaliser off the bench against Luton, Jota scored against West Ham off the bench, and Darwin Nunez, long time ago now, scored 2 goals off the bench against Newcastle, including an injury time winner. So they have had players that have not necessarily been in the starting 11 to come into the team and make differences. And I think if you look at who's going to replace Salah, do they have anyone who can, you know, do exactly what he does? No, but I think Jota will probably come into the team, and he's not on Salah's level, but he's a, you know, pretty good replacement. You've got Gakpo as well. So there are players, there is strength in depth there to, I think, help Liverpool during this period, but there's no getting around the fact that he is an extraordinarily crucial player, one of the best players, that the Premier League has potentially ever seen in terms of forwards and the number of goals he's scored and the impact he's had on this Liverpool team. And obviously they're going to miss Salah, yeah.
So bearing that in mind, Jacob, how important Salah has been for Liverpool, how big he is for them this season, how much he contributed in that Newcastle game. Have they got enough to cope without him? And if so, can they maintain this title push?
You know, Phil was right. They've got more depth, haven't they, in terms of the front line as well. And you're probably looking at the likes of Nunes, but also, you know, Cody Gakpo, Luis Diaz to really, you know, step up from it. But you do feel when you have a player who's, as you say, has only missed 10 games in 6 years, who's as integral as he is, you know, the talisman, that they're going to, you know, feel the effects. And there's been a few games this season where, you know, the Fulham game at home where you think maybe that, you know, they can't, this is not very sustainable, they can't keep going like this. And, you know, having no Salah, their most ruthless, you know, their best player, not having him could be their biggest struggle. But they've got a lot more depth than they probably had, you know, in those brilliant years under Firmino and Mane. You know, they're a great front line, but they did probably have the, you know, strength and depth in behind him, where now they probably have. And they can always rewire it as well. You know, McAllister or Szoboszlai could go into those four positions, or they could change the structure. But, you know, they probably haven't got an out-and-out replacement on that right side especially. So it'd be interesting to see what he does and how it also affects Alexander-Arnold's positioning and dynamic too.
Mark, you seem to have quite fancied Liverpool, not necessarily from the start of the season, but we were talking about who could win the title, and the impression that I've had is that you've always quite fancied them this season.
I have, and bearing in mind, I kind of didn't really think about AFCON that much. I didn't really have it. I was more about Asian Cup because Australia's participation. I kind of almost forgot about AFCON. And knowing that Liverpool obviously do have a lot of strength in depth, but Darwin Nunes is a big concern. I may have tipped him a couple of seasons to go to push Erling Haaland for goal scorer of the season. Obviously, there's nowhere near that. I do like everything about him except the end product. You know, I think he's got absolutely everything to deliver, except he just doesn't have that. And then obviously, that's what he's going to be judged on, right? Obviously. Dominic Szoboszlai limped off, looked like he was holding his hamstring. So let's hope, I don't know, for Liverpool's perspective, you'd hope that that's not too long, because I think he's a massive player for them. McAllister is coming back from injury. He was obviously on the bench. So there are some pros and cons with it, but the big hole is going to be Mo Salah. That's obvious. How do you replace that? But they do have a lot of options going forward. Can they maintain it? I think they still can. But, you know, we look at the table, right, and you talk about who's going to win the league, right? And our Man City people, it's almost running Manchester City off, right? They're 5 points behind Liverpool with a game in hand.
I haven't heard people write Manchester City off. I've heard people going, oh, you know what? Man City are going to win it. Yeah, we're all getting excited. But at the end of the day, Man City, they've got a game in hand. They win that. They're 2 points behind Liverpool. They're going to come back and they're obviously going to win it. We're getting too excited, which I think is a little bit sort of, you know, spoil sport and negative. I think we genuinely do have a title race at the moment. No one has been able to take an advantage over Manchester City while they were away at the Club World Cup. That's true. But if you look at how tight it is, you know, 6 points separating the top five, I can't remember it being that tight at this halfway stage of the season for a long time. And nobody is really taking the division and the race, title race by the horns and saying, you know, we're going to win this. So I think it's anyone's to have a go at, which might, Mark, lead us nicely on to Aston Villa, a subject that Jacob has in-depth knowledge on.
I mean, Aston Villa, like, where are they? Are they second on the table, aren't they? They're doing all right, let's be honest. Go on, Jacob, give us your knowledge on Aston Villa. Can they keep it up?
Let's save that question for later. I think right now, I think Villa fans and everyone around is just bathing in the glory, really. But one thing you could say that's going for Villa, and it might be overlooked more broadly, is since Emery's come in, only Man City and Liverpool have got more points anyway. You know, Villa's home form is the best in the calendar year. So it's not just a flash in the pan. This is not just a, you know, hole from 10 years ago where they started really well, you know, tense for seven or eight games and they just dip off, you know, go steeply downhill. This is quite a, you know, sustained level of form, and, you know, it just shows that this is a really well-oiled team. They're tiring now. I think you've seen in the last three games. They probably need their injuries back. You know, no one's really mentioned it, but injuries have, you know, really plagued them throughout the season. Their Buendia and Mings are out for the whole season. They're, you know, first choice left side, you know, Pau Torres, Jacob Ramsey, Alex Moreno have all suffered injuries too. So they've had a lot of injuries they've had to contend with. But the thing about Emery is he's very effective. He knows how to get the job done. At home, they're obviously, you know, unbeatable right now at the moment, and that's underpinning everything. But what Emery's done is he's just brought a new level of expectation where these players believe they can get top four, and they're going to try and stay in the race to win the Premier League as much as they can and go deep as possible. I think Emery said if they can still be in a race by week 32, then they've done an unbelievable job. So they're going to keep plodding away, keep going, and let all the more glamorous teams fail ahead of them.
Jacob, that's what he's done really well, hasn't he? He's managed, not managed the expectation. What he's done is I think he's pulled the crowd along with him in that they're very well organized, they're really high tempo, high energy, and there's a sense of momentum building at Villa. And without saying they're going to win it or they're going to finish in the Champions League, whatever it is, it's more about a slow burn, but people have joined their journey and believed in the process, I think, at Villa. And that's something that's worked really well, certainly from afar, from my perspective.
No, it has. And it's a bit of a running joke. Every press conference you go to, he always says the same things about being consistent in the structure, but also saying we're not top seven contenders. I think he said that before the start of the season, before the game away to Newcastle, where they did get hammered. He was like, we're not top seven contenders. And then straight after the game, he was like, see, we're definitely not top seven contenders. And he keeps saying it now. He still, you know, points out that Chelsea and Man United are better than Aston Villa. But deep down, if you speak to those in his inner circle, he knows that this is an unbelievable opportunity. You know, with this dysfunction at Chelsea, at Man United, you know, teething issues elsewhere as well. He knows that, you know, to get in the top four or to challenge for the Premier League is there this season. Especially, you know, Man City and Arsenal, Liverpool, their points tally isn't quite as high or a runaway leader as previous years. So I think there's a really good opportunity for them there. But yeah, as you said, he's just takes it week by week. You know, I think before the game the other day, you said, I'm really looking forward to the cup game against Middlesbrough. And I think always in a circle, like, really? But he just absolutely, he just loves it. And they plan, you know, his analysts plan 2 weeks in advance. He just focuses on the next game. It's a real good structure there. And he just enjoys every week and focus on every game and seeing what happens at the end of the season.
Jacob, tell me which players have you seen like a really noticeable improvement under Unai Emery? Because when you get an elite level coach like Unai into a club, the idea is that he implements his ideas, his structures, but also he improves certain players. So I'm sure there's been like a big surge in quality from certain players. Who would you pick out?
Yeah, you probably have to look at the spine of the team, to be honest with you. You know, Ezri Konsa has played more minutes than any other Premier League player in 2023. John McGinn and obviously Ollie Watkins. Ollie Watkins is someone that will take the headlines because his goal scoring record, I think only Erling Haaland and Salah have got more than him in a calendar year. But probably you have to say overall John McGinn, because it was only a year ago under Gerrard where he wasn't getting played. He was on the bench. West Ham were interested in him and he probably thought his days were numbered. I think Villa probably thought if we want to get into the top 10, you're probably not the right guy for us. And yet now he's the captain in that home win against Man City, where probably the best performance of Villa in decades. He was the best midfielder on the pitch by, you know, country mile, really. So to see the improvement in him is pretty remarkable. And it's probably those guys that have been there for a long time that Emery's really just brought them to another level, and a level that probably they didn't even think they were capable of.
I think that's it, isn't it? When you get that elite level coach in and he shows them like, guys, this is a different way of doing things. This is how, all right, I don't want to say this is how the big boys do it, but this is how we do it at the top. You guys are good enough to do this. And it feels like everyone sort of bought into that and you can see it. And yeah, John McGinn, I mean, wow. I've only seen it once live this season. I was at the Spurs Villa game, a game which Spurs, you know, had plenty of chances to take in the first half. I'm a Spurs fan, by the way, Jacob. So I was a little bit disappointed by that. But yeah, John McGinn in parts in that game was really, really impressive. I was keeping my eye out for Pau Torres because obviously I'm based in Spain. I've watched him a lot. I've spoken to him as well before. I was interested to see how he gets on working with Emery very closely during their time at Villarreal. And what do you make of Pau? Because obviously I've always been a really big fan of him, but he does have a slight drop off in awareness sometimes. Sometimes he plays the wrong pass. He's always keen to play the ball out from the back. Sometimes he does a switch off. What have you made of Pau Torres?
No, I think he's been increasingly excellent. And Pau Torres, you said he's worked with him before, so Pau's all too aware of Emery's, you know, hour and 15 minute analyst sessions, you know, that he does three or four times a week, which if they were losing, I think the players would switch off. But no, Pau, in terms of his importance of Villa, I think you've probably seen it when he's been missing. You know, Longley is a left-footed centre-back, but he doesn't offer the same progressive passing, breaking through the lines, and how Emery wants to play, similar to De Zerbi, how he wants to coax opposition forwards onto Villa and then play him through the lines. He's so important in that, and I think he's made, you know, more progressive passes than any other player, more moved the ball upfield more than any other player. I think he's just a fantastic player in possession. There's a few question marks over his physicality and mobility. You've seen a few goals, but he's really good at also operating the offside trap that Villa are, you know, experts at as well. He's great at stepping up just in time. So him and Konsa, when Konsa plays centre-back as well, who's a bit quicker, they formed a really good partnership.
Jacob, you know, you've done a piece on Leon Bailey just recently for The Athletic, and really fascinating sort of insight to his background. I mean, he was one of 23 children adopted by a guy called Craig Butler. Can you give us a little bit more of an insight onto that article and a little bit about Leon Bailey? I mean, he's been phenomenal for Villa this season, 6 goals, 5 assists in 18 games. He's been a bit of a slow burner. Seeing him in Germany has been really exciting, but you got to know him a bit more personally.
Yeah, it's been a pretty remarkable story. I didn't quite realise the story behind it. It took a few months to really go into detail. So yeah, he's one of 23 children that were adopted by this man who's, you know, he was a very rich and successful businessman, but he had ties in his local community. He was exposed to Leon Bailey to gangs and violence before that, and up until the age of 8, saw a lot of, you know, bad things. He was part of a tough neighborhood, and then he got adopted by this man. He obviously had a lot of money, so he was able to set up this football academy, but he realized that Jamaican players weren't probably having the right opportunities to progress into the next level if they want to be footballers. So what he did with Leon and a couple of other of the best lads from the academy is that he just went, brought a bag of balls, brought a rucksack, and they just drove all around Europe going on 200 different trials with various clubs, you know, including Ajax and you know, clubs in Slovenia, Slovakia, things like that. And eventually he got signed up by Genk, I think about 5 years into this journey, where they were just surviving on, you know, cans of tuna. And the rest is history. It's you know, so much detail that, you know, so many things he's had to overcome as well. He couldn't read or write until he was 14, and now he speaks five or six different languages. So, yeah, I think having that type of adversity has probably stood him a good stead at Villa, because, as you say, he was a slow burner early on, but now he's had that belief, and he's always had belief in himself. But I think a coach has given him belief. I think it was pretty obvious that Steven Gerrard didn't have that, where Emery knows that he's very good, and they've been working on his consistency away from home as well. And, you know, now he's probably right now Villa's most threatening attacker, and he's the man for big moments at the moment.
All right, we've big upped Villa. You know, Emery's a fantastic coach. We know that anyway, right? But we've got to play with Phil a little bit, because he loves Emery. Obviously, Ollie Watkins, Leon Bailey. Douglas Luiz, all right, I'm going to put you on the spot. Are they going to be top four? Are they genuine title contenders, Jacob?
I don't think they're genuine title contenders, but the question is, obviously top five could get them in the Champions League. You're probably looking there, but I do feel if one of the bigger teams do drop off, I'm pretty confident they can get top four come May.
We have bigged up Villa, and we've spent quite a bit on today's podcast talking about Villa. Because we've got Jacob, who knows so much about them, and it's a big story. We're at the halfway point of the season. You've got Villa, whose manager said at the start of the season, we're not even top seven, and here they are sitting second, and at the moment in the title race. At the moment, I mean, they might not be there in 10 weeks' time, but at the moment they're there. So I think it's worth, you know, it was well worth us stopping and talking a little bit about Villa. And you know, Mark, I'm just going to stick with my pre-season prediction, you know, if you ask me, because, you know, pre-season I did actually say that pre-season I said towards the end of the season, in the last few weeks, they will be fighting for a Champions League spot. So I didn't actually say they would be in the top four, but I said they would be there or thereabouts. come the final stretch of the season. And I think I'll stick with that, actually, because I don't think they're going to win the title. I think they might have something to say in terms of taking points of teams that are challenging more realistically for it. But them fighting for the top four in the final stretch of the season, I think, is very, very feasible.
We might have to go back to the recording about you saying you thought that they might not be in the top four. They'll be fighting there or thereabouts, because I think you may have said they were going to finish top four. But anyway, it doesn't matter. I think it's going to be really close. I think it's between Villa and Spurs in that top four, top five. Top four, traditional top four. I think it's between Spurs and Villa. And I think January transfer window is going to be even bigger for teams like Villa and Spurs because of the injuries. Spurs have already been mentioned with a number of players as well. So I think for those two clubs in particular, it's going to be huge. And Arsenal, of course, for a striker, that's probably something they big high up on their wish list. Let's move on to one of those teams, Ange at Spurs. They've won four of their last five league matches, most recently at home to Bournemouth. They're still in touching distance of that top four and only a point behind Arsenal. But they've got a big problem as well. They're going to miss one of their most influential players for a month, well, potentially a month, in Son, 12 goals, 5 assists in the league. How do they cope without him, Jacob? Another one.
Well, it's similar to Liverpool, isn't it? You've probably got to look at the other guys to step up. But the thing about Ange is what he's done so well without Harry Kane is he's probably built a more of a collective structure, which doesn't really rely on one individual. He's got, you know, goals from other positions. I think Kulusevski's coming back into his best form. He'll probably, you know, spearhead the attack. And, you know, he's probably not got the strength and depth of Liverpool he'd like, but I do feel they've got a good intensity. They've got a good way of playing. You know, Richarlison, you're still waiting for him to explode as well, aren't you? Similar to Darwin Nunes. I think, and you know, he's had to contend with unavailability throughout the season, really. And sometimes it's bit him, but yeah, I think they're probably in much better position this season to cope with the absence of Son than they were last year, where basically the whole attack was built around two players.
Allow me to be, obviously, we're supposed to be completely impartial and neutral.
I'm expecting you to not be.
I'm actually really worried as a Spurs fan with Son going away, because I think Spurs are so reliant on him, and the drop off to who might try and replace him is so vast that I don't think there's any way that Spurs don't feel it considerably. Richarlison has been better when he's been played through the centre, and Son's been pushed out wide, which is not how they played at the start of the season, but he seems to be better there. So who's going to replace Son? I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, there is Kulusevski, but then on the other flank, Brennan Johnson, not necessarily been overly convinced with him. Brian Hill is a trier. God knows he's a trier, but he does not have that final pass, so the ability to play the correct pass more often than not. We're missing James Maddison badly. So, yeah, it's going to be a really, really, really big test for Spurs. Another one as well, because there's been a lot of adversity for Ange Postecoglou in this first season. It started off by losing the greatest striker in the club's history and has continued with plenty of injuries, loads of suspensions, and they've just about managed to cope with it. But I think this is going to be the biggest test of all, losing the fulcrum of the attack. And I'm not hopeful. I'm genuinely not hopeful.
Well, we talk, Jacob, about the injury list of other teams as well. Like Villa's had a lot of injuries. Spurs have been, it's been a disaster for them.
Everyone's
as well.
Had loads of injuries.
Everyone has. But the teams on the peripheral, so those teams that have looking to join the elite ones in terms of Spurs and Villa, that's often more damaging, right? I mean, if you look at Spurs with Maddison, Romeo out, and Son leaving, just those three alone are absolutely huge for Spurs. I know people will say, well, if Man City lost, you know, Haaland, which they have, obviously De Bruyne, which they have, they're still maintaining a run because they've got a lot of depth, right? So the rest just don't have that same sort of depth. That's the biggest issue, isn't it, for anyone trying to compete at that highest level.
Yeah, for sure. And that's why they are where they are, because they haven't built a squad that has got that depth that can compensate for injuries like that. And they're the ones that are trying to push to reach the next grade, but they have to do it with their best players. So they're always going to feel it a lot more when they haven't got them. But you've seen Spurs as well, the way they play. They've been without two centre-halves for a few weeks now, and yet, you know, you'd probably say that wouldn't really happen at any other team. I know Liverpool had that massive crisis a few years back, but that was, you know, seemed like an anomaly at the time, where, you know, Spurs, they have to be at their best, really, to try and break into, you know, top three probably. But, you know, having these injuries, you're always going to feel it more. It's the same with Villa. The lack of depth will ultimately hamstring them in the end, maybe.
You mentioned the lack of centre-backs. Just shout out to Emerson Royal, by the way. Played centre-back again against Bournemouth. And he was, at some point, something of a figure of fun for Spurs fans who did not necessarily rate him particularly highly. But in the last few weeks, playing at centre-back, he's put in some really, really big performances. He's been quite versatile as well, played in plenty of different positions. Centre-back is not his position at all, playing alongside Ben Davies, who also isn't first choice. But the two of them have been really quite impressive, given that they are very much understudies to the very, very good first choice centre-back pairing of Van der Ven and Romero. So I just wanted to shout out Emerson Royal, because he is, like I said, seems to turn things around with the Spurs fan base, who didn't hold him in very high stead a few months ago.
So you can't underestimate how important having a good manager is, good man manager, and a manager that works with play. So go back a little bit to that John McGinn at Aston Villa. Tyrone Mings under Steven Gerrard were pushed to a side. Now they're massively influential players. You look at Spurs, how important it is to have those players on board, in particular when you have injuries. Like, so Ange could have gone in there easily and just ruffled feathers and gone, right, you know, they're not really my plans, and almost like casting the ones. I've said it time and time again, managers do that, and they find themselves in big trouble when you do have injuries. You can't move those players on. You have injuries down the track and you need to rely on them. Let's talk about Arsenal now, one of the big hitters who are in a bit of a minor blip at the moment, or possibly a minor blip, or just a bad run of form. I mean, they've only won one game since the 5th of December in the league. So, Jackie, is it a minor blip, or are there bigger problems at Arsenal?
I think you'd probably say, if you look at the last couple of years, you'd just say it's a minor blip. Although you do look at Arsenal now, and they're lacking that second change of gear, aren't they? They're looking at quite formulaic, quite you know, structured. And I know Arteta loves it. You know, he loves everything controlled. But they, even when they were winning early this season, didn't feel quite the freewheeling, entertaining team, you know, quite as fluid as they were last year, which is a bit of a surprise, given, you know, they've taken away Xhaka, who's more of a centre midfielder, and they've tried to bring in Kai Havertz, who you think is a bit more offensively minded. So, yeah, it's looked a little bit like that. They've been just going through games, trying to have that control. But when they lack that bit of, I don't know, energy, pizzazz up front, you know, Saka, Martinelli are struggling. Jesus, obviously, is not the most reliable clinical goal scorer. Then you probably say, actually, they look quite one-paced and one-dimensional. And against teams that will sit deeper and then counter-attack, like West Ham or Fulham have, if you are looking one-paced, then you probably will be exploited at some point. So I think they just need to find that change of gear and need to find that attacking spark from somewhere. Maybe you look at the depth and see someone on the bench, but yeah, I think it's just a minor blip, and I'm sure they'll get back to winning ways soon.
If you're to put your finger on one thing, Jacob, what do you think they are missing?
I think that, as you say, I think they're missing an actual number nine that can finish the chances, that gets in the box, that stays in the box. You look at Jesus, he was at Villa a few weeks ago playing, and I think he does everything apart from getting the box. He's excellent, but you look at gets transferred out to Saka and Martinelli. They've got triangles down either flank, but then you look in the box and you're looking at Jesus or Nketi to get in there, and you see who they bring on. It goes back to that argument of strength and depth. They bring on Reece Nelson, Eddie Nketi, these players who, you know, are good players, but if you want to win a title and if you want to, you know, in these games with fine margins, will they be the difference makers? I'm not too sure.
Phil, if you look at their run coming up now, they've got Liverpool on Sunday in the FA Cup, right? Is that their most, well, I suppose, realistic way of winning a trophy this season? Because, I mean, if you look at their squad, you look at the way that they're not really performing. I kind of see a little bit of cracks in Arteta, certainly losing. He's very, very non-responsive in his interviews to any probing question. Then they've got Palace at home, Forest away, Liverpool at home in the next three league games after that. Can you see it going pear-shaped at Spurs? At Arsenal? And not that you put your Spurs hat on and hope it goes pear-shaped. Do you actually genuinely think it will?
No. Listen, I'm only impartial when it comes to talking about Spurs. I echo everything that Jacob was saying, actually, in terms of Arsenal and the kind of like formulaic play we've seen from them in the this season compared to last season. You kind of know what you're going to get. There doesn't seem to be anything different in the way that they try and create their chances. There seems to be just a lot of passing in and around the penalty area without any kind of direct sort of penetrating balls or runs into the box. You look at the strikers and their goals, and they're just way down on numbers that you need to win the league. I know Saka's got 6 goals this season. It's a goal every 278 minutes. That's not enough. He's the top goal scorer. Martinelli's goals are way down on last season, or maybe overachieved last season in terms of goals. Maybe he isn't a goal scorer. Jesus has got 3 goals all season, and Eddie Nketiah has only scored in 3 games this season, and the last time was 3 months ago. So if you're trying to put one, you know, your finger on one thing, it is a lack of a clinical goal scorer. And are they going to go out and try and fix that in January? And there's been loads of speculation of Ivan Toney potentially leaving Brentford and joining Arsenal. If you were trying to think of a ready-made fix for Arsenal, it would be someone as clinical as a finisher as Ivan Toney, even though, you know, he hasn't played for 8 months and you know, I don't think Brentford are going to let him go. But that is one suggestion for Arsenal. Sorry, Mark.
That's the thing, though. Like, Ivan Toney, this is just blows my mind, right? I know his record at Brentford is really good, right? In the Premier League, yeah. Something like 67 goals really or good. Something like in 100 games.
Really,
right?
Really good. Yeah,
it is. But he's had 8 months out of the game. He has a problem, a sort of a gambling addiction problem. Surely he needs to get games under his belt between now and the end of the season, get his head right.
The thing is, he's not been injured. That's the thing. He's not been injured. He has been playing sort of friendlies behind closed doors. It's not as if he's been coming back from a horrific injury. I'd say it's not worse now. I mean, you're the ex-pro. You tell me, is it harder to come back from a layoff where you've just not been allowed to play in competitive fixtures, or if you've done your ACL? I would say that.
I've never had an ACL, like a really, really bad injury like that. I've had an injury that's been serious, that's kept me out for, say, 3 months or so, but not so much where you think, right, I don't know, it never really bothered me coming back because you knew you were fit. I don't know. I think that when you've had other issues away from football, personal issues, and obviously there's a mental aspect to it. Think arguably that's more difficult. And certainly if you haven't played for 8 months and you've not been allowed to even train with a team for that sort of period of time as well. So I would envisage that would even be more difficult. I don't know whether Ivan Toney is necessarily the answer right now, say for someone like Arsenal trying to push for winning the title and finish that top four.
He's the answer for Brentford, maybe.
Well, that's more for me, right? What do you think, Jacob?
I honestly think Ivan Toney will just offer something. Even if he doesn't score, I think he will just offer a bit more of a focal point. I do think he's someone that can just hold his position a little bit better, can stay in the box. He's not quite floating around. He doesn't have to do everything like Jesus is doing. But I can see the argument. I do feel Brentford won't sell him anyway because survival is more important than any money they get for him this season. And you have to also look at his headspace as well. You know, if you saw those interviews with him he'd done a few months ago, he still did quite seem over. You know, I'm not a psychologist, so I can't really judge. But if you just from a layman's point of view, he did quite seem over it and accepting of his charges. So I think for him, if you're looking to do character references, like I'm sure Arsenal would do, that would have to be taken into account as well, whether to sign him now or wait a few months and wait till the dust has settled somewhat.
Yeah, so for Brentford, it's vital to keep hold of him. They've lost 7 of their last 8 Premier League games. They're 16th. They're only 4 points above Luton in 18th. Surely they just can't let Ivan Toney go. I mean, Thomas Frank has got... I mean, I don't care who it is. He's got to feel the pressure, certainly just to keep Brentford in the league. I'm not saying he's in the pressure of losing his job necessarily, but which I don't think he is. I think it's more about that pressure of keeping him in, keeping them in the league, but also keeping hold of their biggest asset.
Yeah, for sure. But the problem has been exacerbated by, you know, Wissa and Mbeumo, especially Mbeumo being injured for long, because at the start of the season, they were probably just getting by, weren't they? They had reconfigured a little bit of the attack. Mbeumo was looking like, you know, he could step up and replace Toney in somewhat in terms of his goal output. But he's got injured now as well. So you know, they're really lacking. You know, I went to see Brentford a few weeks ago and they did everything right, really. I thought their intensity was good. They were as direct as ever. They were less aggressive, but they just didn't have that cutting edge at the end, and they could have killed Villa. But then they had a player sent off and the tables turned. So, you know, they have to keep them, you know, because of where they are, because there's a threat of them of getting dragged into a relegation scrap, also because of the other injuries too.
Phil, would you take 100 million for him right now if you were Brentford and Thomas Frank?
Oh, well, I'm not sure 100 million is a figure that anyone's going to actually pay, but maybe 100 million might make them think. I think maybe a more realistic figure of, you know, 50 or 60 million. I think it's what Jacob said. I think it's not worth it in terms of Premier League survival is more valuable, both sort of emotionally, but actually literally financially, it's more important to stay in the Premier League than to get that money in now. And given someone who can score goals like Ivan Toney, who has consistently scored goals in this division, and as we know, in a relegation battle, a team that has a proven goal scorer is going to have a massive, massive advantage. So no, I don't think that they would take, you said 100 million. Would they take 100 million? I think 100 million might make them think, but 50 or 60 million, I don't think they would take, no.
That flows in nicely to my next team, Manchester United, about a proven goal scorer. Obviously, they don't have one. Ramos Højlund scored his first goal just the other day, which, I mean, look, the guy's got so much pressure on him. He's, what, 21 years old, 20 years old? There's a lot more problems than just the number nine, right, Jacob?
Yeah, there is. And you probably have to look at the deeper problem in terms of the other number nines they've got. You know, Anthony Martial should be the senior striker at the club, but, you know, he should be just easing bedding in Højlund, who's, you know, he's got great potential. But a year ago, Southampton were confident of signing him, you know, and in a year, all of a sudden, he's turned into the £75 million striker that Man United are trusting to lead their line, and he's not quite there yet, but he could be there. But you're looking at Anthony Martial, you think you're the guy that's been there for 9 seasons now. You should be there leading the line, and, you know, most of the time, he looks disinterested and injured. So, you know, that probably speaks volumes of the actual issues inside the club rather than Højlund himself, who's just a young lad who's still learning and understanding the rule too.
I mean, it's going to be a big January transfer window for them. I mean, Sergio Reguilón apparently is going back to Spurs. They've not taken up the option to lengthen his loan spell. They're talking about Varane leaving the club, Casemiro and Anthony Martial in this January transfer window. I mean, whether that happens or not is another thing, but that's what the talk is at the moment. That's not sustainable then, is it, to then push on, bring in 3 players or 4 players to replace them, Phil, and then end up in the top 4, right? Because that, I mean, when you look at where they are, and I mean, they're what are they? They're 9 points off a top 4 place right now.
Yeah, they are. I mean, it's not just the points as well. It's just the way that they're playing is just...
Lost 9 games.
Lost 9 games. I think, you know, 2023 was their worst calendar year for something like 50 or 60 years. You know, they've never lost this many games in a year for so long. So, yeah, it's just that they're genuinely not playing well. I don't think that they're going to get rid of Ten Hag now before the end of the season. I think they'll stick with him. Obviously, Sir Jim Ratcliffe bought his 25% minority stake on Christmas Eve. We'll see what kind of effect that has on the planning for the club in terms of the long-term future. I don't think, like I said, I don't think Ten Hag goes before the end of the season, but it just feels like this season is it's more or less written off. I mean, there's nothing that they can really sort of genuinely hope to achieve. And okay, all right, they might win the FA Cup, and you know, it's a trophy, and but I don't think they will. You think there's so many other better teams in England at the moment than Manchester United, then that would be a massive achievement. And in terms of top 4, they're just so far away from getting back into the Champions League. And even if they did, okay, they get the money and they get some prestige and they can offer that to potential signings, you know, okay, we're in the Champions League. But look what they did in the Champions League this season. I mean, they crashed out of a really, really winnable group. I mean, okay, not winnable, but a group that they should have gone through, you know, pretty comfortably. And they were miles off the pace. So they're so far away from being what they were. And I saw a tweet from someone, and I can't even remember the exact wording, but it was like, for people who grew up in the 90s, watching Manchester United, seeing them now is like running into the guy who used to bully you at school, working outside a golf shop, holding a sign by the motorway. So, you know, it's incredible to see how they've fallen. And I got that sense when you and me, Mark, we went to the Manchester Derby there at Old Trafford a couple of months ago, and it was really, you know, interesting experience for me just to see the grandeur of this club is in such stark contrast to where they are at the moment, because they are miles, miles away from what they once were.
I think the best way to describe them at the moment is a bit like that day we went to Old Trafford and you see the stadium roof leaking. Hit three different parts of the ground. So for me, the best way to describe them is falling apart. And that's the stadium as well as the team and Ten Hag and his regime at the moment. The players he's brought in, Anthony, for example, Onana, they don't seem up to the level, the standard. I mean, Onana's been a real disappointment for me. I mean, I know one of their best second half performances, one of their best performances or 45-minute performances was that second half performance against Villa the other day. But if you look at the two goals that led up to it that they conceded, Onana again was heavily involved in both of them. He does not deal with crosses in the box. He conceded the first goal was exactly the same as the one he scored conceded in Turkey against Galatasaray. He struggles with that. Defensively, they're all over the place. Two of their best players have been two players that have been on the out and they want to get rid of Maguire and McTominay. Jacob, where is there a light at the end of the tunnel for Manchester United fans?
That's a far down the track, isn't it? Because, you know, Ratcliffe come in and he's going to be in charge of all football decisions, but it's only 25%. And ultimately, at the end of the day, those that were, of course, that rock will still be there. And you look at, as you say, you've mentioned two players, Onana and Anthony. And Anthony was someone they could have got for 25 million, 30 million euros cheaper a few months before that. But because of the indecisions, because it takes so long to get anything signed off by the Glazers, they ended up panicking after two defeats at the start of last season. And, you know, spending 85 million on Anthony, who, you know, surely no scout at United thinks he's worth that much money. But it comes back to Man United giving all the power, all the autonomy to a manager who, you know, he might be a good manager, but there's so many issues, isn't there? He's constantly having to fix things. And then at the end of the day, his own career and his own influence gets stifled in the end and goes down with the ship.
Well, part of that issue, I think, is we've touched this on previous podcasts, is that Ten Hag has probably never, ever been in charge of player recruitment. I mean, I'm sure he's had a say, but the structure at Ajax is very much so that one individual doesn't have the ultimate say, whereas at United, he's been given that, right? So he's been, certainly with players that have come in recently, it seems like they are Ten Hag signings. That is a very, very dangerous game to play at a club like Manchester United with the money that they have. I mean, not only when you look at Anthony, Højlund was another player they've paid massively over the odds for because of that delay in making a decision in bringing players in. So can you see anything changing now under the new kind of guidance?
Well, that's been an issue, under David Moyes when he brought Marouane Fellaini in. So it's not just a Ten Hag thing. This has been going on for years. But I think the important thing for the new guidance is that they've got fresh eyes now. They've got Dave Brailsford, who, okay, he's from a cycling background, but he knows, you know, about elite environments, and hopefully that means that he brings in people that know how the club works and hopefully shares and separates control away from the manager. But still, it's going to be very difficult for the funding. They need to change this team, but more importantly, they need to make sure they get the structure of the club right. And Ten Hag and Unai Emery, if we go back to are very similar in terms of they're very insular, they're very football-minded, very narrow-focused. They don't really look at the bigger picture. And that's why you need a good support network around them. Emery's got that Aston Villa. I think it's up to Dave Brailsford and Jim Ratcliffe to build that for whoever the manager is there.
Phil, I want to put you on a spot regarding Manchester United right now. FA Cup aside, we've got Wigan away, but if they were not to get a result against Wigan away, I mean, that would be alarm bells massively for Manchester United. But then they've got Spurs at home, Wolves away, West Ham at home, and then Aston Villa away. I mean, can you see a scenario where they pick up very few points in those four games?
Yes.
And then Ten Hag could be out the door?
Well, I mean, I literally just said 2 minutes ago that I think he'll stay until the end of the season. But yeah, I mean, you know, going through those fixtures, I think there's every chance that they do pick up, you know, quite a few, few points. You know, not many points at all. Obviously, Spurs are Spurs, and they're missing the players that they're missing. But they will give Manchester United a very tough game. Wolves are in terrific form. West Ham are very difficult to beat, and I think it's a difficult run of games. I mean, if you lose every one of those games and you lose to Wigan and it's just completely untenable, then okay, maybe they do pull the trigger. But it just feels like they're just going to limp on until the end of the season, because they've been so wildly inconsistent, and they have been. If you look at the wins that they've had as well, they've not been wins that have just sort of blown teams away. I mean, against Villa, they came back, didn't they? Against that was the terrific comeback. What was it when Scott McTominay scored 2 goals late on? It was against Brentford. I mean, there've been games against Fulham. They won 1-0, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a great game. They haven't had any massive wins and performances, but I think if you can grind out a few results, then that will see him get to the end of the season, and then they can maybe reset in the summer. But yeah, I mean, it's just a bit meh from Manchester United. It's just, you know, there isn't really anything to get excited about, even from a neutral perspective, apart from just the novelty factor for, like I said, people of my generation, of seeing Manchester United struggle quite this badly for such a sustained period, which just was completely unthinkable when we were growing up.
I just want to briefly just talk about West Ham and David Moyes. Underrated. Is he one of the most underrated managers in the league, Jacob? What he's done at West Ham, they're 6th on the table, won the Conference League last season. Yes, the league form struggled off the back of that, but they still got the job done. He's on the verge of signing a new 2-year contract.
No, I think it's fully vindicated that he gets an extension. When you speak to West Ham fans, there's always a few people that are unsure about David Moyes.
Yeah.
Like, fair enough. I know the football was a little bit, they want to look at themselves in terms of more possession base, more dominant in games. And, you know, they've got a good calibre of players as well. But they had one off-season last year, and it's quite refreshing that actually West Ham stuck by them. Actually, a manager can go through dips. That doesn't mean they're going to get relegated. They're still going to have some success, some great success with the cup, but they can have some dips in form. Not every year is going to be linear where they keep progressing in terms of their league position. He's come back. He's got a great quality of players. I think he helps with the recruitment too, but there's also other people deciding. You know, he's got some shrewd players. You look at that midfield now, you know, with Ward-Prowse and Alvarez in there. They've had to replace Declan Rice. And then you look up front and see what he's done with Jarrod Bowen. I think he doesn't get enough credit for his individual coach. And, you know, we spoke about Emery of John McGinn, but I think he's done the same with Jarrod Bowen. Now he's playing as a striker, as a lone nine, and he's doing excellently too. So, yeah, it's fully rewarded that he gets that 2-year contract, and I think they can beat anyone on the day, and that's what makes them such an intriguing team, doesn't it?
We'll move on to La Liga, because I want to touch on, hey, what about the news coming out of Spain? Carlo Ancelotti to sign a new contract at Real Madrid. What is going on, Phil? He was going for Brazil, and now he's staying at Real Madrid.
Carlo Ancelotti has just played an absolute blinder. All he's done is just sit back and allowed everyone else to talk around him. And he had the Brazilian president, Federation coming out and say, yeah, it's signed, it's done, we're going to get Ancelotti. And he was just sitting there going, no, I'm not talking about my future. I'm not talking about my future. And Real Madrid realised, hold on, I think we've probably got the perfect manager for us at the moment. Let's not lose him because his contract's up in the summer. Let's extend him. So that's exactly what they've done. And when I say that he's the perfect manager for Real Madrid, he is. Not just because he is a tactically very astute manager, and it's something that he does not get credit for. And I think the way that Jude Bellingham has fitted into this Real Madrid side, we've got to give big credit to Carlo Ancelotti, the way he's structured it, particularly with the loss of Karim Benzema, but also in terms of man management, managing the most difficult dressing room, managing the expectations of the most difficult fans in the world. Carlo's perfect. He genuinely is the perfect manager. And I think Real Madrid have realised that. Also, there's a lack of clear-cut successors, potential successors. There's a very handsome, extremely talented former Real Madrid player doing brilliant things in Germany at the moment. But I don't think the moment is quite right for Xabi Alonso to take over. And I think he's certainly got a job to do in Leverkusen. So they've just decided, right, we'll keep Carlo for a couple more seasons and then we'll see. And Ancelotti's pretty astute as well. He knows that really it's very, very unlikely for people to see out their contract at Real Madrid. Usually you get sacked at Real Madrid. That's what happens usually. So he just sat back and said, right, I'm going to see out my contract and then we'll see what happens. And he put the ball in Real Madrid's court and they've decided to extend his contract. And I think it's the right decision. That said, there's quite a few Real Madrid fans who aren't very happy and they want a change and they want someone new to come in, and they were clamoring for Xabi Alonso. But realistically, I think this is a very shrewd decision from Real Madrid.
All I got out of that was a thought in my head that Phil has got a man crush on Xabi Alonso. That's all I got out of that. Sorry, I mate. I switched off.
I have a very public man crush on Xabi Alonso for many years. I think he's amazing. I loved him as a player, love him as a manager, and think he's, you know, got a terrific skincare regime.
Would that have been too soon for Xabi Alonso to take over at Real Madrid? Say at the end, like start of the next season. So, is it the sensible choice? And is it potentially that Perez has already spoken to Xabi Alonso and he's gone, you know what? I want another couple of seasons outside of Madrid. I don't want to be there just yet.
Yeah, I think that's really quite possible. Is it too soon? I mean, his career trajectory has really been quite, you know, he's achieved quite a lot quite quickly. He was in the Real Madrid Youth Academy. He was training there under 15s, I think it was a few seasons ago. And he left there and then he went to Real Sociedad B and did really, really, really impressive things with a Real Sociedad's B team. And then from there, he's jumped to Bayer Leverkusen and taken them to the top of the Bundesliga. So it's been, you know, in sort of 3 years, he's getting himself to the top of European football. So it's all happened quite quickly. He's still only 42 as well. He's an extremely young manager. And I think there's still time for him to take the Real Madrid job in a couple of years. So I think he's in no rush. Real Madrid seemingly have decided to consolidate things with Carlo Ancelotti. But, you know, he's a name that's being talked about a lot with Real Madrid, as was Raul, the former striker, of course, who's the manager of the Real Madrid B team. But that just doesn't feel like he convinces the Real Madrid hierarchy, because, you know, if it did convince him, then there probably would have been a chance for him to take over in the last few years or so. And that hasn't happened. So I think in terms of former Real Madrid players in line to take over the first team, Xabi Alonso is certainly ahead of Raul.
It's kind of one of those, the same sort of scenario at Manchester United, Jacob, isn't it? Like, if you look at Real Madrid and the size of Real Madrid, the challenge is bringing in a guy that can handle the club, can handle the supporters. I'm not so sure if they're the most difficult supporters. I mean, Barcelona fans, the city where you're in right now, would probably disagree with you, Phil. But that's part of the problem, right? Trying to find the right personality, not only to deal with the pressure of running a club like that, of that magnitude, but also the players and the expectation on and off the pitch.
That's why he's such, Ancelotti's worth his weight in gold, isn't he? Because he gets on with it. He doesn't look phased at all. Even during games when he scores goals, he doesn't look phased. I think it's really important. And especially this vintage of Madrid as well, which is quite a young, hungry team. It hasn't probably got the egos that it previously did. And he's found a way around it. You know, remember that he hasn't got a striker really that's of Benzema's ilk this season yet. He's rewired the formation and things like that, and he's actually engendering better strengths, or more conducive to Jude Bellingham. So, you know, this Ancelotti is just very important. He knows how to manage big clubs, and it's okay going for these young progressive managers, but, you know, it's very difficult to stamp your authority in these big clubs, where Ancelotti knows how to do it. He's been everywhere. And that's why he's so successful. And that's why Madrid realised that there's no one else is better than him.
All right, Phil, Barcelona, yes. The other massive club in Spain, even though you don't talk about them very often.
Which is the city I'm in at the moment. Yep.
Yes. They've got transfer news. I still can't understand how this is even possible. Come on, explain it to me. And who are they going to sign?
I wish I could explain it to you, but it's beyond my comprehension at the moment as well. They've brought in Vitor Roque, who is a player that they'd signed in the summer, but they've actually brought him in now, the Brazilian striker from Atlético Paranaense. He is now in Brazil, in Barcelona, and he's going to be presented, we think, on Friday. He's an 18-year-old. He scored 12 goals in the Brazilian Serie A last season, 4 goals in the Copa Libertadores. You know, good numbers for an 18-year-old forward. But maybe, I don't know. I mean, I've literally never seen him play, so I can't give you any kind of analysis of what kind of player he is. I'll be honest here. I do not follow Brazilian football, but people are getting very, very excited about him, perhaps too excited about him, or perhaps not. You know, perhaps excitement is what football is all about, and we shouldn't be such Grinches, and it should be exciting when they sign a Brazilian wonder kid. What maybe we shouldn't do is have too much expectation. People can get excited, but when they start expecting him to come in and immediately perform, maybe that's where there is a little bit of a danger. And I was reading some quotes from the former sporting director of Atletico Paranaense, which was his club, and he said Vitor Roque is very, very similar to Ronaldo Nazario. So just building him up there and making everybody go wildly off the scale in terms of expectations and excitement. Listen, they need another striker as a backup for Robert Lewandowski, who is 35 and who has looked very, very, very tired of the last couple of months, not least because he plays basically every minute of every game. So they need other options, and they also need someone to provide competition for Lewandowski as well, to, you know, not literally, but, you know, metaphorically, maybe give him a kick up the backside and maybe spark him into life a little bit. So it's in theory a good signing, but in practice we'll have to see, because like I said, he's 18, he's come from Brazil, literally never played in Europe before. So we'll see how it goes. But I know. And if you're asking me how they can do this, I do not know. And at the time of recording, they have not registered him yet. He is not registered with La Liga to play. So I'm not sure what levers they're going to have to pull, what they're going to have to sell off to be able to register him at the moment. But he's not registered at the time of recording. But people are suggesting he could even play the next league game. So I'm genuinely not sure what's going on, Mark.
I think that's the favourite terminology at Barcelona, levers. Levers.
Palanca. Just, yeah.
Yeah, everything is about levers at Barcelona these days. Just quickly, Rayo Vallecano, first game back after their mini break over Christmas in La Liga. Get a win under their belt, your team.
We get to talk about Rayo on the podcast.
Yeah, come on. I'm getting a chance.
Okay, yeah. 1-2-0 against Getafe yesterday. Getafe had three men sent off and Rayo sat back, were 2-0 up and just held on for a 2-0 win after all those red cards. So they ground it out. They hadn't won for a couple of months. They hadn't scored for four games. So it was a really big win for Rayo. Now, I'm wearing my Rayo shirt today, so this is why you've asked me, I know. So I'm gonna wear my Rayo shirt more often when we record the podcast to get to talk about them more.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. Remember, every game of La Liga and the Premier League is live and exclusive on Optus Sport. See you next time.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.